That was lame. All right. Anyway, Groovehouse is failing on his job. There we go. All right. Up next, it's that, you know.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to Technology Bites. I'm speaking very loudly right now.
You are hearing my voice.
The chair is against the wall.
The door is ajar. Oh, wow, man. All right, welcome to Technology Bites. Loving the static. Loving it. Perfect show.
Don't hear it.
That's all you.
That's all in your head.
Jiggle the handle.
Put your tinfoil hat back on.
I didn't touch anything. When he was lifting stuff up is when I heard it.
Oh, well, I didn't hear anything.
Me either.
Okay. That's not me.
Jiggle the handle.
Technology Bites is running. Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
So Lee Hutchinson is
the new guy, right?
The new guy, yeah.
We try to keep you guys around.
Well,
we get them, don't we?
He was here last week during our fundraising extravaganza success, he said.
Wasn't here the week before, went to Germany.
No, so this week he went off, you know, well, after last week's show, he headed out of town to go on a ski vacation. He goes apparently with his wife every year to Aspen or
apparently he's
one of those
places. Geeks and sports.
He's a bit of a ski bunny.
He said he was did okay.
Yeah,
you know?
He said be careful. I said, oh, no, I do this all the time. Blah blah blah. So he jinxed himself. Yeah, he broke his humor. Well, I don't know if he broke.
He's no longer in good humor.
No,
good humorous.
He's getting to play the part of a snow bunny.
He's laid up with a drink in a ski chalet. I think he's probably better
than
we are right now.
And probably some pain meds.
Yeah,
so
the part of the email gave me that impression.
Yeah,
so he's putting on an even better show than we are.
I think you might listen on the stream. Yeah,
I think he should call in if he's you know feeling a little loopy.
People are sitting in the chalet, and about 40 seconds ago, he said, "And I'm Lee Hutchison from Ars Technica." Started doing the show. He's saying stuff you just can't hear it.
All right, sign in and take a look. It says I'm going to join the Google Hangout.
Take a look. Jiggle the handle and take a look.
Oh, look.
Just make sure and mute your microphone.
Oh. Let's see. How do I get to my audio properties?
When you join, it should, if you kind of mouse around in the browser window for the Hangout, then they'll appear at the top.
All right. I see the people, and I don't see any video. Let's see, Terry. Okay. Enabling last scene lets you see contacts. New Hangout. Start a video Hangout. No, don't want to start. Do-do-do. All right, so I'm looking at this thing. I'm trying to join a Google Hangout so I can see Peter Hughes' lovely face.
Oh.
So I've got this little window.
I sent you an invite.
I got the link. I'm looking at this thing. It says click to join the video call. There it is. All right, there we are.
Do-do-do. Oh, I wonder who that could be.
Wow, you're friends dark. Click allow above to turn on your webcam. Okay, here I come. Hooray! There's the echo.
You're going to have to mute your side, Jay.
Mute. All right, we have been muted.
Mutated.
There, perfect.
Perfect, yay! Except Click that just keeps coming back with a picture that I took of him a long, long time ago, which has become the default avatar for Flicked. And it's weird, when I talk, I just see Flicked's face.
Yes, and the pulsing. Same here for me.
Yeah,
even when you were talking, actually, it had. I think you can click on whoever to make them to show them.
Oh, okay.
There's an algorithm, so more or less, it gives weight to whoever's mic is picking up the most noise than if they move. But also, I guess in anticipation of switching over to someone,
I think
that
I just clicked on Peter's window.
Yeah, and it maximizes.
That's not a euphemism either, but I just clicked on his window.
I want to see Pete.
You want to see Pete here?
Can I get an invite, or is that going to slow down?
Oh, yeah, invite Barrett.
You need one of them valuable invites that we're handing out?
It's the show within a show within a show. I got some Gmail invites, too, if anybody wants
any
one.
Any ketchup invites?
Well, say ketchup.
Ha, ha, ha. I never get to live that down, do I? No, sir, you do not. All right. Okay, I should probably look. Now I need a dual monitor set up so I can have Pete over in one screen. I wonder if I should get that iPad.
So we should do. We could do just a single camera in here, and you know have. Well, we could do dual camera.
Actually, we could
put
do it.
Pete, like, just put him at the
table.
Who still
has a webcam they can bring over?
Telepresence.
No, I was thinking I've got this iPad that I don't use for much.
Yeah, prop it up.
Prop it up on the window. I'll get some Velcro and stick it up there.
I dig.
Or we're working out some new.
Pete, the disembodied head.
We're working out some new ideas for the show so that we can see Pete and hopefully have that allow us to interact with him better.
And then just so you feel like I'm there, I'm going to put a cardboard cutout of me on a Roomba and have it going around inside the studio during the show.
Nice.
Well, we'll just put the iPad on that.
Or just a cat in a shark suit. One of the two.
No, shark suit kind of jumped the shark suit at the Super Bowl, didn't it? I mean, did you see that?
I didn't see the Super Bowl or any of the commercials.
I didn't see the Super Bowl, but, I can catch up really fast on Twitter. And
were there good commercials or...?
Mostly
there were some disturbing commercials, apparently.
Were there IT commercials?
Like, they went for the bummer approach. There was one with some, like, this cute kid, and you kind of identify with him. You know, he's talking about he'll never do this and that in his life, and you're waiting for the funny punchline. And basically the funny punchline is, but I won't do any of those things because I died in an accident. And it's like,
And then it shows a bathtub full of water with water overflowing.
What kind of accident did he die in?
I don't know.
Probably like his parents not paying enough attention to buying insurance, which is what was being.
You don't
sold.
Die from lack
That's,
of insurance.
Wasn't like a new Fox, you know, creepy spinoff coming up in the fall.
Nope. It was nationwide insurance, and Twitter lit up after that one. That one was all over the place about what a bummer, because it just took a sudden left turn. You know, you're kind of like, okay, I'm with you. You know, the kid, the little boy who, you know, I'm never going to kiss a girl and those kinds of things.
I'm never going to get cooties, and there's like little animated little monsters like running over the shoulder.
Oh, don't bum me out. I dodged this successfully. There's no reason to bring us down.
No, it
already
wasn't nearly
it
as
sad.
Depressing as
yeah,
that.
But knowing where it's going, it sounds sad.
Yeah, but you that all gets taken care of when you start learning about left shark.
The best commercial was the Snickers commercial.
Google Left Shark.
That one was pretty funny with Steve Buscemi.
Oh, Danny Trejo and Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, that one was funny.
Which one was that?
The Snickers commercial.
I didn't see it.
That one was viral even before the Super Bowl. Basically, a scene from the Brady Bunch. Except
oh, that one.
Marcia,
yeah, yeah, yeah. I did see it. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Danny Trejo, who is just so full of awesome. And then they really buy. Usually, there's only one star in a Snickers commercial like that, and this time having Steve Buscemi in a surprise, you know, end thing to it was kind of perfect.
At the top of the stairs.
Yeah. You know, Marcia, Marcia, Marcia.
But yeah, the shark thing was really funny, because I think originally there are two sharks, one on each side of Katy Perry.
And they're supposed to be choreographed.
That's the thing is, so they say that everybody thought like, oh, he really goofed up. But then the thing is, the choreographer said that there was a part earlier that they were supposed to be choreographed, which they did perfectly in sync. And then the choreographer claims that after that, they were just supposed to kind of do their own thing. And so the other shark's like all smooth and stuff.
Crisp shark
and
motion.
And the one on the left is just sort of hitting himself and flopping around.
That's actually fairly funny. Okay.
He left shark became the star of the Super Bowl.
All right. And that's
ZZ Top actually tweeted or Facebooked out, every girl loves a shark dressed man.
I saw that. You put that out there. Now that makes sense. Okay. A little context.
Yeah. Sharks. Sharks. Week. All right. Well, welcome to the show. We're glad you could tune in. Thanks for ignoring us during the fundraiser. We appreciate that. No, some people did actually.
Some people stepped through.
Stepped up, and we do appreciate. I do actually have a few web thanks I need to find here and thank them for pledging online. Let's see. We have one person. Abdul made a generous pledge. There he says. Your contribution to restore freedom and democracy in the USA is outstanding.
I really hope that wasn't meant for Saeed or Amy.
It's possible.
We'll take it.
We did the fundraiser. If you pledged, thank you for pledging during the fundraiser. If you have not paid, be sure and follow through, as Rourke Smith said in that promo or PSA earlier. You know, you did the easy part. The hard part's coming when you actually have to pay. So be sure and respond to any invoices or reminders to pay your pledge, because your money, the money that was donated, is more important than ever, because I don't think we quite made our station goal either. So keep that in mind. And you can always donate at any time. You don't have to donate during fundraisers. You can donate whenever you care to by going to kpft.org and clicking on the tip jar. All right. So, yeah, speaking of websites, we have one. Geekradio.com. That's where we post all the information about the show and the podcasts and stuff like that. So you can always visit us at geekradio.com. It's also a way to contact us if you have a question or want to bring up a subject and you don't do it on the air. You could do it via the website. You can also hang out with us, IRC, Internet Relay Chat. irc.cuckoo.com is the IRC server. The channel is Tech Bytes. If you have your own IRC client, just join up on irc.cuckoo.com and jump in the channel. If you don't have your own IRC client and you want to learn about IRC or figure out how to be a part of the IRC, just go over to geekradio.com and click on the IRC link, and we have a Java client there that will let you join up the show within a show. So we invite you to do that. I'm thinking about like moving my laptop around a bunch to see what that does to Pete.
Yeah, don't make him burp. Into
just
the Google
see if I
Hangout.
Get the dog to bark.
All over the Hangout.
All right, so phone number, which we will be going to if you have something interesting to talk to us about, is 713-526-5738. If you have a spyware problem, just go to geekradio.com and click on the spyware's link. Everything I could possibly say about spyware is right there, and, you know, good luck. So what we're going to do now is we're going to go to San Antonio and do the Technology Bytes Info Shot with Peter Hughes. Take it away, Info Shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
I think I'll do this first story sort of nationwide style. You know, isn't Radio Shack great? Don't you love going in there and looking at all the stuff, you know, the cool, you know, the all the little electronic pieces for projects and stuff like that? Well, it sounds like Radio Shack is very close to not among the living of corporations. They're about to go bankrupt, apparently. Apparently, a lot of them will become Sprint stores. There's also some rumors that they might be turned into some Amazon stores. Radio Shack's been in decline for several years, and yesterday, the New York Stock Exchange announced they would delist the failing company's stock. Rumors are swirling about the impending bankruptcy and its plans to sell about half the 4,000 stores to another company. So with that rumor, they think with the Sprint thing, so under that, then Radio Shack would stop working as a separate entity. The Chinese backers who took the Brookstone chain out of bankruptcy also have been in discussions about bidding for Radio Shack assets, one person familiar with the talks said. Let's see, and then USA Today suggested Amazon might be in talks to turn some of the Radio Shack stores into showrooms for tech sold by the online retail giant. According to Ars Technica, Radio Shack is not confirming currently any of these rumors, but so that, it's sort of sad. The problem is, of course, there's most of this stuff. I think most people, when they go, gee, I need a really obscure part that I want to order, or I really need an obscure electronic part or something like that, then they don't think Radio Shack anymore. They think Google, and they look it up and they order it from somewhere online. And so that hasn't been going well for Radio Shack for a long time. Another story that this one's a little more positive. There's a big change coming, and business-wise, that it's sort of Windows XP deja vu all over again. Microsoft is pulling the plug on an old beloved Windows operating system. And no, it's not Windows Vista or 7. It's Windows Server 2003. And the deal is, I mean, that came out 12 years ago, and now technical support for it ends on July 14th. And computer makers like HP and Dell are licking their chops over it because it means customers will have to upgrade. So where you're working, you may find that there's a lot of changes around about July because they have to replace the software. Either that or go unsupported. And most businesses, if you're large enough that you've got this kind of stuff, they're not going to go into an unsupported mode for Windows servers. I guess also if they stop putting out security patches for it for people's servers, they'll accept that a lot longer on a desktop operating system than they would for their servers. So server makers believe that this won't just cause companies to buy new computer servers and upgrade their Windows to the current version, but that they'll need help installing those servers. They may also need help in upgrading the ancient business software that's forced them to keep that ancient version of Windows for so long. You know, here's my suggestion. Maybe you should go with Linux because that's free and you can, like, hire people who know how it works for a lot less money than Dell and HP are salivating over to charge you for it. But, you know, just know that one's coming up. Or if you happen to be, you know, running a server, then you know if you're running Windows 2003 that it may be time to start investigating your options. Maybe this is sort of a bummer story. There's a popular calendar application called Today Calendar Pro. And in a Google Plus post, Jack Underwood, that developer, says that 85% of the installations of his $5.99 calendar app are not paid downloads from Google Play. The numbers are even more depressing for Monument Valley, a popular mobile game on both Android and iOS. Recently, the team behind the Puzzler said only 5% of the installations on Android were legitimate. Now, the deal with this is with apps is that, you know, they're not that expensive. And so it's one thing, you know, in the olden days, you know, Microsoft benefited from piracy because when somebody pirated Word or Office or whatever, at some point they tended to have to go legit. And now they, with these apps, basically it's just outright theft. There's no opening for that to turn into revenue for the manufacturer of the company. Ironically, neither the devs behind Today Calendar Pro nor Monument Valley were all that upset by the piracy figures. Underwood told Torrent Freak that he doesn't see it as lost revenue, as those who pirate would find a way to do so anyway, which that's kind of fatalistic, except where this means something is big companies that want to do stuff and they're deciding whether to do it on iOS or on Android, they're going to be that much more encouraged to do it on Android and not keep up with it, or not do it on Android and do it on iOS, because the Android market won't pony up. It's kind of like, I don't know, like if you have a public radio show and people don't call in and pledge, just saying. So that's an interesting one. Next time somebody offers you, if you're on Android and if you're an Android aficionado, next time you see somebody offering a freebie of an app, I mean, I can't believe who pirates a $6 app for your business. That just seems, that's a little odd. And finally, a couple of political stories, and not political like politics, but I guess government policy. This one's an interesting one. The White House is expected to place new limits, you don't usually hear this, on government surveillance, with a set of rules that will offer some additional protections around privacy and transparency, according to the New York Times. The biggest change is reported to be a requirement that intelligence agencies delete any private information from U.S. citizens, such as an email or phone conversation, that was collected incidentally and is not relevant to national security. Such information from foreigners must be deleted within 5 years. I wonder how this is going to change. You know, the NSA has that giant data center because they were going to capture, like, every phone call, email, whatever, and store it all for a long time. Now, if it's incidental and they're supposed to do it immediately, then, you know, the foreigner stuff for 5 years, well, there might be a good bit of that, but I think the majority of that data was really going to be Americans. So we'll see how that plays out. I mean, if they do it and if it's implemented as stated, that sounds like a good positive step. But of course, this does nothing to address the government's continued bulk collection of telephone metadata. Obama has said that he wants to continue the program but get the data out of the government's hands, leaving it with a private party where the government would have to receive a court order to ask for the records. Exactly which private parties would hold the data and how they'd keep it secure reportedly still remains a holdup. Times reports that private companies haven't been eager to hold on to the data voluntarily, and the government may need to have Congress mandate the storage to get the phone companies on board. So, you know, there's still some interesting aspects to it, but at least this is the first time that they've started to back down or back up on keeping all of our data and using it for other stuff later. And finally, and this is the kind of biggest story, this one blew up today. We've been talking about net neutrality and that the FCC was going to announce what they planned to do, and that they would have to vote on what they're doing later in February. The FCC commissioner chairman, Tom Wheeler, today came out in full support of Title II reclassification of broadband internet. That's a dry way of saying that internet service providers like Comcast and Time Warner would not be allowed to offer paid prioritization of certain content and would be prohibited from blocking or throttling traffic. Basically, he put in, this is kind of cool, it was in an opinion piece at Wired. Chairman Wheeler writes, quote, "I'm submitting to my colleagues the strongest open internet protections ever proposed by the FCC. These enforceable bright line rules will ban paid prioritization and the blocking and throttling of lawful content and services. I propose to fully apply for the first time ever those Brightline rules to mobile broadband. My proposal assures the rights of internet users to go where they want, when they want, and the rights of innovators to introduce new products without asking anyone's permission, unquote. So the big thing with this is it's not just going to be Time Warner and Comcast. It'll be AT&T and Sprint and Verizon, everybody who offers mobile data. With Wheeler on board, it's likely the FCC will pass these proposed rules in a 3-2 vote at the February 26th meeting based on the makeup of the committee. The news leaked from the FCC, this wasn't in the op-ed, said that the FCC is going to take on the 19 to 21 states, depending on you count, that have laws preventing local governments from building their own broadband networks. This decision will make it much easier for local governments to offer municipal broadband services that directly compete with private ISPs. This shouldn't be a surprise. You've heard us talking about them over the year, and this kind of stuff has been bubbling up. But now it's coming time to formally do it. In an article in Fast Company and talking about it, one of the things is that the telecoms are in a tough spot with this because of the way that he's doing it. The logic goes like this. Even if the Title II classification doesn't stand, if the telecoms sue, consumers will still have a choice for unrestricted, unthrottled, untiered internet access through municipal broadband. So basically it's a 1-2 punch. Either the utility thing goes through and then there's limits on what Time Warner and Comcast can do, or there's a chance for your local government, if they want to put in a broadband system that would compete with them. And that they can't get rid of both. Basically, if the telecoms sue and say, oh, you can't do this as a utility, then they can't say, oh, well, but you also have to regulate broadband if it comes from a city or town. Because they can't argue both for regulation and deregulation at the same time in a courtroom. So it's kind of clever on that one. The one thing that they're specifically not going to do, and this one, Peter Bright at Ars Technica had brought it up last year, something called last mile unbundling. And what last mile unbundling is, Wheeler said they're not going to do it. That's one thing that's called a forbearance. When the FCC says this law is going to apply, but these aspects of it don't apply in this particular situation, we're not going to enforce it in that situation. The last mile unbundling is where we've seen it some before, like it happened in Texas for a while, where smaller upstart ISPs would basically rent space on another ISP's existing infrastructure. It's a program that's popular in Europe and has been used to great effect because laying the physical wires for broadband service is very expensive. So you don't have a bunch of ISPs starting up every week, and that's how basically Comcast and Time Warner have managed to monopolize, is because basically they already had wires going to your house, but they're not going to do the unbundling, and so that won't be mandated. So we'll have to see what we get from the other ones, and that is the news. I think that's definitely some of this is of interest to talk about. In the past the idea was like it'd be like electricity deregulation because of the utility thing. If you could start an ISP and rent space at a regulated rate from Time Warner or Comcast, then you'd have the chance to create your own ISP. Right.
Yeah, let's start our own ISP.
TechBytes ISP. Yeah, well, at the very least, you'd be able to buy in bulk. You'd wonder about corporate. The thing that would get interesting is, I don't know if you've ever done commercial, business internet is not cheap. And the rates you get, I have a company that I consult for, for IT stuff for them. And they get for like $100 a month or $150 a month, they get internet that you or I would be really upset to pay more than about $15 a month. I think they get 15 megabits per second down and 1.5 up.
Yeah, TSPs. are very different to companies, telecom service providers, like AT&T or Time Warner, WorldCom, whatever they are, that they spun off from Time Warner. There's a bunch of them, but
look,
they're not cheap.
Yeah. Dedicated lines like that, dedicated circuits are pretty expensive. Even like if you try and get like, you know, like your cable modem service class, you know, through Comcast, the business class, it's going to triple or quadruple the price. But fiber, we've started renegotiating a lot of our fiber contracts, and those have come down by like, you know, a quarter. So you can actually, it's actually, I think it might be cheaper than some home services if you do the math, because you can get like, you know, 100 megs or, well, maybe not. It's still pretty expensive. Forget that. Because, yeah, 100 megs of fiber is still going to be, like, if you get a really good deal, say $400 from a no-name kind of thing, all the way up to much more than that. And you can get the same thing for home for, like, you know, just barely touching three figures.
But is the business stuff...
But that's full up and down, though. That's 100 megs up, 100 megs down, which is nice.
Because you don't have the up, and you don't have... And you have a lot of port blockage.
Yeah. But then once you start buying above that, though, it gets a lot less expensive because you can get a lot more fiber for just a little bit more money. So... Yeah, like Pete said, if you could buy a big chunk of fiber, split it up, you get kind of competitive pricing.
You also have to have, hopefully, somebody in your immediate area who has already bought it. Because
they won't just build up for you.
Yeah, well, they, no, I mean,
they
will.
But it's expensive. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're the first one in your area, you're basically paying for the outlay of the original line going to that area.
Paying for everybody else.
The splitter and, I mean, everything they have to build out. You're paying for it. So if you're the second one, your cost is like, you know, 1/10 or less of 1/15, 1/20 of what the first person had to pay. So you just have to wait out other people.
That's correct.
I invited you.
That's the way you coast along on other people's dime.
I went ahead and invited Lee to the Google Hangout.
Oh, is he there?
I don't know. I just invited him. We'll see what happens. did I read somewhere that on the Radio Shack thing that Amazon was going to buy some of theirs?
I didn't see that. I heard what Pete heard, and that half of them were being converted to Sprint. Then they were still talking about what the other ones would happen. Amazon, I was looking at a lot of cross-dock kind of shipping locations.
Yeah, I don't know if that was speculation.
I think that was speculation.
But I think some people thought that Amazon, I guess, had talked about doing that, so maybe somebody... connected this in their mind as an opportunity for Amazon to pick up some brick and mortar stores
Wired
that already existed.
Wired said that they're in talks.
Okay. Mm. Well, speaking of what Peter said, you know, it's true that, you know, if I want parts, you know, I will a lot of times go online and go like to a SparkFun or an Adafruit or a Mouser or a, you know, there are a ton of places out there. But I mean, there are some days I just want wire, and I wanted 50 feet of like 8 to 12 gauge wire, and I went to Radio Shack thinking, surely they still have wire.
Yeah, that's exactly.
No, they
that's
don't have wire anymore.
Car chargers.
I know. I thought about like, okay, if I bought 8, you know, really overpriced car chargers and cut them and soldered them together, I'd have enough wire. But
see,
I was desperate. I needed 50 feet of wire.
I don't
and there.
Do electronic stuff a whole lot, but a couple of years ago, I had a universal remote where. It had worked for several years, and then all of a sudden, when the backlight came on the buttons, it wouldn't turn off. It would stay on and run the battery down. And so eventually, I read online and I figured out. Somebody said, "Oh, it's this crystal that's used as a timer. It goes bad, and so if you unsolder that and solder in a new one, and they're like, you know, this is a really common crystal because a lot of like cheap watches, like the $1.50 watches and stuff, use it. So I was like." Well, this is a really common crystal used for timers all over the place. I'll just go to Radio Shack and grab one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to Radio Shack. And
we have a timer.
I was like, where's your like loose, you know, electronic parts, you know, resistors, capacitors, stuff like that. And they're like, because I kind of walked around the store. I didn't see it. And they're like, oh, yeah, because they had like, you know, all kinds of hookups for like audio, little bit of video,
stuff like that.
They, you know, speaker hookups and splitters.
Video cables,
and...
you can still get those there, I think.
So he's like, oh, yeah, here it is. And it was like, you know, those pull-out trays that they have.
Yeah, like
it was,
the bin of just everything.
It was basically about, I would say, 12 to 16 stacked, like, you know, one and a half inch pull-out trays that were maybe, you know, 24 inches wide. And that was it. That was their loose component, electronic.
That used to be how many, and this might be an exaggeration. That used to be how many crystals they would have in the store. Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, that my first 8086 computer was a Tandy, So I got it from there. And, you know, I had, you know, VIG stuff and I had stuff before that. But the first 8086 with the Math coprocessor was purchased from there. And, like, the first time I made any kind of boxes with various colors, I got the crystals there. I actually got the little dialer. They actually sold a little dialer. So you could go and, you know, for, you know, a handful of pocket change mid-80s, you could get everything an enterprising young phone freaker would need to go have, you know, a weekend worth of fun.
Well, and they used to sell those like 1,101 kits or whatever that had the, I don't know if you remember those, particularly like Barrett or Flicked,
those were awesome.
Where it had the little springs and you just had short lengths of wire that you could, you know, follow the instructions
wire, yeah.
and patch it together and make, you know, electric circuits and do all that stuff. Yeah, and there's nobody offering an equivalent to that.
For the last 5 to 10 years, they've switched from the 101 science experiments kit to 101 different cell phones you could buy.
Yeah. There, however, so there's been an answer to this. So where the
101 cell phone kit.
The vacuum tube now left by Radio Shack is being filled, as far as the experimenter kits, is being filled by a couple of Kickstarter campaigns that are doing that. And what they're doing is I think they're building in like a little Arduino or microcontroller, but they're still giving you all those breakouts with the wire apps, with that old school feel, with the wooden box. Mm-hmm. I think the big difference is it's not like the, you know, the $20 it used to be in $1970. They're kind of, you know, you think about all the work that goes into them. They're bespoke. They're kind of expensive, but people are doing that. I think that'd be a really cool, like, homemade project if Jim Thompson ever decides, hey, the Blinken box is taken on its own sentience and it's left. He should build one of those cool kits.
You know, here's another thing for hipsters is, you know, you can't do it right away, but you can prepare for it. If Radio Shack goes out of business, go and buy all the little odd pieces, not the like phone cases and car chargers, but all that drawer full of that stuff. You buy all of those things up, and then in a few years you rent a cheap location and you put all that in there looking like an old Radio Shack store. And sell vacuum tubes and all that old stuff. And you know the hipsters will just be lined up because it's so retro.
That was the first time we ever had a number two in the three steps to profit. And you just gave it all away.
Well, I couldn't do it because I don't look hipster
enough. I do think there's going to be a run on...
You've got the mustache for it, Barrett.
Anything that says Radio Shack, I think that's going to be a little bit collectible. I know that I'm going to probably try and make a run and get like a magnet fridge or something that says Radio Shack if it's really about to be an end of an era kind of thing.
I'm just going to ask people for their zip code if they want to get anything from me.
That was really off-putting. It did. It became kind of, you know, an affront to shop there. They just want a little bit too much information. It's like, do you really need all this? I'm paying with cash. I'm buying speaker wire.
My shoe size? Really?
Just wait. Once they close the doors, then phase two of their plan kicks into action. They're going to use all those zip codes for some plot.
That's even here in Houston, they built a Radio Shack as recently as like maybe 5 or 6 months. Maybe it's been a year, but there's a fairly newish one over there on I-10 and like Heights right around in there, Sawyer.
Really?
So they must not have either. Someone was really hopeful or their marketing plans did not match up with their earnings sheets.
Well, I would be curious to know if there's anything at Radio Shack currently in the current incarnation of Radio Shack that cannot be bought on Amazon Prime.
I doubt it.
You know the actual thing that I've gone into Radio Shacks for and gotten the product that I want is batteries for the various mm-hmm. you know like car devices that you have that require oddball batteries in them because they'll crack them open and figure out what battery you need, sell you the battery and install it for you. Which nobody else does that.
They're lonely and they don't want you to leave.
The last thing mm-hmm. I got at a Radio Shack was a couple of years ago. I was actually able to buy a converter for a plug for travel overseas. And they're pricey. It was just, you can get it for a couple of bucks at Amazon. And they wanted, you know, $10 or $12 for it at Radio Shack.
That's almost airport pricey.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess the other thing that Radio Shack probably made a ton of money as I flash back to the, you know, late 70s and early 80s when I would have been in their target market for it is the kind of like cheap ass audio equipment, you know, like the little amplifier, the little 2-channel 10-watt amplifier thing that you could hook up to your CD player or whatever to power some speakers and stuff like that, or a crummy car amplifier.
All the realistic cassette
all that stuff.
And
now
that
they
stuff.
Buy. Now people just buy that from Amazon with some brand name on it that they've never ever heard of.
Olympus.
No, there was somebody. Was it on? When I was looking for the news. Somebody at CNET. Who does like audio stuff, and they were testing some speakers, and it's like Lepai, LEPAI amplifier, two channel amplifier, and it's this little tiny, you know, 4 inches wide box, and it's like $30 or $40 to power speakers, and he was using it with some higher end speakers and talking about how it really worked pretty well, but that used to be the kind of stuff that you go and find at Radio Shack that you couldn't find anywhere else. You know, if you went to a stereo store, they wanted to sell you something more involved,
well,
I guess.
On the plus side here in Houston, you still have places like Electronic Parts Outlet.
Yeah, they're stuck. Actually, Fry's has actually become a little bit better as far as offerings. EPO seems more kind of makery and more, you know, kind of roll up your sleeves and get in there. But a lot of their stuff tends to be... a little bit older, and you got to do.
I think the sad part is though that in the suburbs and in the rural areas, Radio Shack was kind of all there was, and that's the ones. And those locations, you know, those are not going to turn into Amazon locations or be desirable to be Sprint stores,
nail salons.
You know? they're just going to close, and then somebody's going to have to drive to. You know, you'll have to be in a major city where you can get a place like with a Fry's or a Micro Center or EPO or those kinds of things.
So 19, I guess it's
the end of an era. We'll have to watch that one. We'll let people know whenever the last days are for Radio Shack.
1920s, a single store in Boston selling ham radio gear. So I bet there was a general amount of people when they stopped selling all the ham radio gear. Yeah, but they always kind of had scanners.
Evidently, I didn't know this. Assuming it's true. I don't know if it is because, you know, I saw it on the internet. But, you know, it was Radio Shack and, you know, it was TSR's Tandy Radio Shack, which was Tandy Leatherworks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's why you could buy both of those. You could buy leatherwork kits from Radio Shack for a while, which I thought was awesome.
I'm just wondering, how did a leather store get into electronics? Because it seems like very different mindsets.
It was. I know that
it was
Tandy,
more of a makery thing, I think, yeah, because the leather kits were like you could make your own moccasin boots.
So they made leather computer parts.
Well, no, they made kits to where you could actually make your own leather goods. So it was like, you know, Boy Scout summer camp without having to go to the summer camp. They would give you all these different pieces of leather and the different tools and the hammers and instructions for tooling and doing stuff. And you could make a saddle or a key fob or whatever you wanted to do. So there is some overlap.
So the idea was just making
that.
Stuff right. from raw components.
Well, that's what I mean. Because I had the 101 kit. You
Moccasin
know.
Kit.
Oh, you had the leather kit?
No.
Oh, I was going to say, you had the 101 the
Not
electronic
until I moved to the Montrose.
Hey-o.
No, I had the 101 electronics kit where you could make the radio, you could make the ham, you could make the thing where you could listen in on ham radio, you could listen on different radios, you could make a clock, timer, things like that.
I'm going to jump to more modern electronics. Have y'all happened to see the Kickstarter campaign for the product called Kraftwerk, which is spelled like the band Kraftwerk?
No, one more
time.
It's
a Kickstarter.
Kickstarter now.
It's a Kickstarter campaign for... a product called Kraftwerk, which is, it's interesting. It's like a charger device that you can carry around with you, but it actually runs off of like lighter butane or camp butane, and it actually converts it directly from that into electricity.
So we finally have a fuel
It's a fuel cell.
Yeah.
It's a portable fuel cell. So you can fill it in about 3 seconds. And then that 1 3-second charge of it will give you, I think they were saying, like about 11 or 12 full iPhone charges. Like full
so
charges
while we've
all
been
way.
Waiting for the last decade for fuel cells to come to fruition, someone just said, hey, I'm just going to stick some butane from a lighter and let's go.
I was reading it and it almost seemed fake. But
that's cool.
They've raised a lot of money. And, I mean, the guy who did it, they started it in 2008. He had worked for fuel cell companies. And they said they have... 27 fully functioning prototypes at this point, and so they're just trying to get money to ramp up production. And most of their campaign stuff is, you know, like to spend money to to get one of the, you know, early models of it, to get it at a cheaper price than what retail will probably be.
I think that, I think that's great. I think somebody should start another Kickstarter to give those to the homeless, and then they can sell phone charges to people on the street.
Okay, so Jay was kind of, Jay was on the money when he was guessing about the whole Makery thing as far as the link between Tandy and Radio Shack. So Tandy came around. They were just more or less in the – I guess there was a split. At one point, they were making shoes and doing leather-making kits, so they did a split. The main guy that owned Tandy, Charles Tandy, went and took the leather tooling company. They did their first mailing catalog to the readers of Popular Science, and that was kind of their hook into the market. And then, yeah, and then later they went ahead and bought Radio Shack, acquired, probably trying to expand their market catalog stuff and in line with, you know.
Well, and computers were kits.
Yeah, 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 same thing. So it all just kind of went hand in hand.
Yeah, it wasn't like you could buy pre-made computers.
Well, and there was, you know, the Maker thing is, in a sense, is kind of retro because, I mean, that used to be the, like, the, you know, there was that category of 70s dad. My dad was not one of those, but there was that category of 70s dad who had the workshop, mm-hmm. and who did stuff with wood and or with leather, and some of them had the electronic stuff, you know, soldering. How many people's first soldering iron that they ever owned,
or wood burning kit,
even, Radio yeah. Shack wood burning stuff.
My first wood burning kit was a soldering iron, I think. So it looks like when they went off and bought Radio Shack, it looks like they bought a handful of other companies. They were just covering the bases. So exactly, they bought Maribee Art Embroidery Company. So they were, I guess, looking to tie up the ladies in the 1960s, and also Cleveland Crafts Inc. No, I'm not being
phrasing.
I mean, that was probably their mindset in the 1960s. I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, sugarcoat things, but they probably, you know, this was Mad Men, the time of Mad Men. You can almost
they were
see
trying
Don
to
Draper
make a category
like, hey.
Killer like Hobby Lobby is
it,
now.
But it looks like what they were trying to do is, I guess this would be what is horizontal market integration. They were just trying to get everywhere, all sex, to tie up the, yeah, to tie up the kind of hobby and mail order craft market. That's pretty cool.
All right, well, it's cool. About 15 minutes before the hour. Did we want to do the try, buy, or fry product thing, or...
Sounds good to me. I've got four.
So,
this time they're pretty quick.
So let's add
the craft work to that list.
All right. Well, this is the segment that we like to call try, buy, or fry, new product discussion. So Pete, what do you got?
Well, should we on the Kickstarter one? I think I would put that under. If I were going to say, I would put it under the Kickstarter thing, I would put it under try or fry, because I don't know. I've found that my devices, the battery life has been growing enough that I don't need a separate thing to charge them up.
Well, I agree with that, because I don't have a landline anymore, and so I just have the cell phone, and so I had to get on the phone with Comcast last night.
Mm.
And I thought, do I need to get my charger?
You break your humerus?
No, but I was able to get on the phone, and it took about 45 minutes to get it done, but still plenty of battery left when I was done. You know, no problems there.
I don't know if I like the whole, was it try, buy, or fry? I don't know. That's painful to me.
It's
all often, I'll buy, I'll try, and then it'll fry, and I get all three at once, and this is too close to home.
Well, I just tried to think about carrying a container of butane around with me.
It's actually, so they say that it's already been passed by the FAA or whatever, as far as being able to carry it inside the cabin of an airplane.
Oh, fuel cell stuff?
There's,
oh,
their,
cool.
Their follow-up project that they're just starting is a big balloon full of hydrogen that also has a Wi-Fi hotspot on it, and it just follows you around, and you can use the hydrogen to power the fuel cell. Oh, the humanity!
Wi-Fi
phone is charged, and I have an internet connection. But...
Yeah. For me, I don't think I'm enough away. I'm away enough from electrical sources for it to seem like really interesting to me. But I mean, you know, it could be like if in a disaster situation, or if you're camping for an extended period mm-hmm. of time, or anything like that, it could be really convenient to be able.
Well,
to charge,
Ike, you know, a handful of years ago, I mean, there were parts of, you know, Houston that were out without electricity for a handful
I was
of
out
weeks.
For a
that
week.
Would have been nice, yeah, to have. Where you would want multiple charges, and you would want to be able to power something, radios, you know, for instance, you might get tired of
and it doesn't
cranking
it doesn't
after
weigh
a while.
Very much, because it's just the device and you know, the
and it's pretty ubiquitous as far as the fuel goes.
And you can,
and
yeah, you can pretty much go into any store and buy, you know, the little butane refills.
Or if the power's out for an extended time, you can go to any store. You can't go to any store and steal electricity, but you can loot it for butane.
Yep.
I think I'm going to San Antonio when the zombie apocalypse hits. I think Pete has the right mentality here.
All right. Well, the first one I've got is there is an actual announcement of when the Apple Watch will ship, which is it's according to Tim Cook, and this was in their like earnings call, so the tech folks weren't listening to it. It was mostly the business people. He said that the Apple Watch begins shipping in April. So first off, I know Barrett's not really eligible on this one because he doesn't have an iPhone, so it's not so it wouldn't work with it. So that sort of narrows it down to afflicted Jay and I. But I must say, with an iPhone 6 Plus, the Apple Watch sounds kind of tempting to avoid having to pull the big screen out of my pocket to like check who's calling and stuff. So I would put it under at least try, possibly buy.
Yeah, myself, I think I'm somewhere between try and fry because I basically got away from wearing wristwatches, and I don't really know that I want to go back to wearing one again, like even with the added functionality. But, you know, I also, when the first iPod came out, I thought, and it ended up being, you know, gangbusters. So I don't know. But I don't think, for me right now, I don't think it would be a big deal. And like the iPad wasn't, I still don't have one. I never found a big need for that. So I feel like the watch will fall in that same category for me.
Well, I was thinking on, you know, I was talking about the iWatch or the Apple Watch this past weekend, and I didn't feel like I was talking about something really stupid like I did when I first started talking about the iPad. Like, it just didn't make sense to me. And even though there was a part of it that appealed to me, there was part of me that said, I'm not going to get this because everybody so far that I've seen with one kind of has that
pretentious
douchebag stigma to them.
I'm pretty sure that'll be the case with the Apple Watch.
Yeah, but, you know, it's, I don't know. I kind of like it, but I don't know that it's now it's falling into the second phase of iPad ownership is where I like it, but I can't really justify paying for it because
that's the thing. For me, it feels like it's fairly expensive. And I mean, maybe they'll change the trend, but it seems like the trend has been going to bigger and bigger tablets, bigger and bigger phones. And now you're going to put like a really small screen on your wrist. And I just,
it's marketing. Apple's like, we got to make the screens bigger to open up new space in the small segment.
So I don't know. It seems like a weird form factor, and I'm sure for some people it'll be incredibly useful. I'm just not sure for the
you wonder.
General
it's almost
public.
You almost wonder or wish that maybe they had been braver about it, and instead of making the watch a companion for the iPhone, make it a companion for the LTE for the iPad. So the idea is that the watch gives you that phone kind of functionality and access to it as long as you have your iPad somewhere near you, you know, within Bluetooth range.
Yeah, but with iOS now, the new iOS, you can get phone calls on your iPad and iPhone, you know, get phone calls on your iPad and on your iMac and your MacBook Air. So I don't know if that would really serve a purpose or not.
Because it kind of, you know, they seem to be pushing, you know, they're not afraid to cannibalize their own market. But it seems like, you know, so if you get an iPhone 6 Plus and the watch, that then that's going to make it less likely that you would get an iPad, where if you did the iPad went with the iWatch, you might be more likely to just get all of them.
Maybe so.
I'm pro wearable. I like the idea of wearables, but I think they need to open that up to where you can script it, you can code it. No, that's just me saying whatever, but I know Apple's never going to do that. To me, that's a little too expensive to make into a wall.
You can go buy a Pebble.
Yeah, even that, I don't know. Like I said, I'm pro-wearable, but I'm not sure if the watch form factor is quite it.
In a related one, Sprint has, I hadn't heard of this one before, but I guess it's been out for a little while. Sprint has a for-life leasing program, And basically, the newest version of it they announced this week is a $100 a month package that includes an iPhone 6, a 4G iPad mini 3, and their service plans. And what happens is, instead of owning the device, your devices outright, you lease them for 2 years and trade up to the latest version at the end of each contract, where you just keep paying the same amount each month. And it actually costs less than buying, because obviously you're leasing. It's not a huge, savings.
Has anybody worked out the math for what amount of price difference is between buying it outright and leasing it for 2 years?
Let's see. They
do,
said
do you have an option to buy it at the end of 2 years?
Separately, a rented 16-gig iPhone 6 with unlimited plan would cost $70 a month, while a 16-gig iPad mini 3 would run $47 a month, so there's a savings of $17 a month for the 2 years. Plus, you're not ponying up for the new device. You're not paying $200 or whatever for the upgrade to the next device, you know, the next iPhone. If you really liked Sprint and were into all this and wanted the newest of this stuff, you actually do save money as long as you're okay with it. You don't own it at the end.
But if you bought it outright and paid nothing to them for those 2 years except for the service plan, and then you sold it at the end of the 2 years on somewhere and bought new ones, you know, you might actually make out better than leasing it for those 2 years and saving $17 a month.
Especially with Apple Gear. I mean, Jay Lee's shown that you can definitely flip gear and not come out, you know, with a big frown.
Yeah, I mean, I've been able to sell my phones all the way back to my Windows phone for a fairly good amount of money on the secondary market. I'd rather own it.
I get that. It was just an interesting approach. And then on the Android front, the Dell Venue 8 7000 is out and getting reviewed. That apparently it's a fairly high-end one with a I'm trying to find the screen resolution is pretty high. It's I think it's 2560 by something, and it's about $400 and has a 3D camera and a kind of bezel-less look. So I guess we can pick up on that one maybe after.
We have a Barrett time at this.
We kind of did, but let's pause it because it actually was very pledge-centric Barrett time. I thought I could recycle it, but I can't. But we have announced, we really can't. It's like it's the nationwide commercial. I don't want to bring everyone down with pledge stuff.
Okay.
There are announcements after. So we do have a Geek Gathering coming up. We got some cool stuff. But we can take care of that when we come back.
Right. Okay, well, we're going to take a short break here and do some station business. You're listening to Technology Bites here on KPFT. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Cuckoo.
KPFT is seeking prospective volunteers to help in our music library. Our music library is a massive resource for our DJs and listeners. Volunteers will be assigned a number of different tasks, from refiling CDs to converting music for inclusion into the upgrade of our music library focused on digital. We're also looking for people who can spot up-and-coming bands to feature on our HD3 music stream. Successful volunteers will be team players who work well with others, have the ability to alphabetize, and can manage multiple tasks. Shifts happen weekdays, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. This is an unpaid volunteer gig, but it is one of the most fun times ever for anyone into music, music discovery, and turning others on to outstanding music. Interested? Drop an email to music@kpft.org with the subject line Music Volunteer. We'll take it from there. This is 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
First you listen, then you fall in love. You have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week. And finally, you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today. And when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you.
You listen to KPFT, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial-free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT. But be warned, that fantastic feeling will soon follow. Thanks for supporting KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Technology Bites. So Barrett kind of had a Barrett time, but...
I forgot that it was extremely pledge-centric. Sorry.
That's okay.
Okay, also, well, I guess yeah, we can continue.
Well, we do have a couple of announcements.
So the cool thing is, this is it's the first Friday after the first Tuesday in the month. Flicted, is the math right on that? I think so. I do know it's, yeah, this Friday?
Yeah, it's this Friday.
2808 Mile Image is where you want to be, because we do have the Geek Gathering coming up, so the February installation.
Yeah, I think the first was a Saturday, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it is the first Friday.
Yeah, yeah. So at Cones, Midtown, things start a little bit after 7:30, and the cool thing is we're actually going to have a Moog, I guess, Werkstatt 01, like a Moog synthesizer out. Also, I guess people call it Moog. But I think the guy's last name is pronounced Moog.
Yeah.
Did you say Moog?
It's often referred to as a Moog synthesizer or a Moog synthesizer. Yeah. Moog is the proper pronunciation, but when you see it written down, it's Moog.
I'd always heard Moog for 39 years. And then 2 years ago, all of a sudden, I guess, when he passed, all of a sudden everybody's like, it's Moog.
There's also a documentary
that
says how to say
it. But yeah, before that... I don't think I'd ever heard it.
So there's a tie into the show on this, too.
Well, for those that don't know, the theme song for the show and the little break music that we play before we take the break is our popular songs performed on Moog synthesizers. Buddy Holly by Weezer, which is our primary theme song. It's performed by the Moog Cookbook.
I thought it was the Cookbook.
Coke boat.
That'll make a lot of people mad.
And then the theme at the end of the first hour is Hotel California by the same band performing that song on a Moog.
So
on a Moog cookbook.
I'm going to stay away from that. So we're actually going to try to program in some Moog cookbook songs into an Arduino to recreate the show's theme music and even maybe the bed music before we go to the half or the full hour break.
Yeah.
Because I'm not that musically inclined. And then the Werkstatt only has one octave of keys, so we're going to have to
Can you send MIDI to it?
Yeah, you sure can. So what
so
this
you should
is,
be able to find MIDI for Weezer, I bet you can.
Yeah, I think so, but you've got to send MIDI to it. I'll have to send it to it from the Arduino, probably, or from something.
But is it a monosynth?
Yeah. Okay. So for the most part, what it is it's almost like what Pete was talking about earlier. It's the little project kit. So what they did was they had a Moog Fest that happened last year, 2014, and they made a small handful, a few hundred of these synthesizer kits where participants could come in and put together the synthesizers. And it was everything from putting in a single, oscillator to having a variable control for that and some pulse width modulation, and then do a lot of ladders Moog does to get the different, cool depth to the sounds. And you could do a lot of different things to it. So they put it all in one kit. They made it very hackable to where you've got to assemble a lot of it. It shows up and you've got to put the board and do the buttons and just do everything like that. But it's got a couple of rows of headers where you can take anything that is produced by any of the electronics inside there and bring those out and pipe it back into itself, or you can hook up external things. So while there is not a MIDI, for instance, there's not a MIDI plug on there, you can wire up a MIDI circuit in such a way that you're able to accept MIDI input. Pretty easily. So it's a lot you've got to do the wiring, but it's pretty easy to do. And I think there are protection circuits built in, so you're not going to get blue smoke. You're not going to short it out. Hopefully it won't be a, try, buy, and fry situation. But yeah, we'll bring that out, and then hopefully we'll have the thing playing some legitimate sounding music by the big anniversary party.
Just in case you've got a ton of money in your pocket because you didn't pledge, I think in January, Moog announced that it would reissue an extremely limited number of rebooted instruments from its extinct line of modulars from the 70s. Now, the least expensive of those was about $10,000, but they've been meticulously recreated from the original 1973 schematics with the original type. You know, basically, it's the original kind. The whole thing is original, as opposed to, you know, using cheaper materials to build the later knockoffs. It's Moog doing it right, and apparently, what you get for your $10,000, assuming you have it, is apparently pretty amazing because it is the old school for real Moog stuff. But it looks like a giant, you know, like
a giant
Moog
money,
sword.
Moog money, Moog money.
Moog money, Moog problems.
Yay, cultural references. So, yeah, the Geek Gathering will be this Friday, and we hope you'll come out. It's always a good time.
Fire pits maybe would, depending on the weather.
I'm thinking the weather's going to be too good for fire pits.
Is it going to get warm?
I am this close, and I'm holding my fingers very close together. I'm this close to getting my Cutlass back.
Yes.
So
rain in the as far as the eye can see from whatever day Jay brings that convertible on.
Well, it's going to have a brand new convertible top, so I will actually be capable of driving it in the rain, which I don't really want to do. But if right now, so they're supposed to come in the morning to the shop. The people are repairing the top to get the frame. I had to buy a new frame for the top, so they're going to attach all that and bring it back and put it in the car, put the seats back in that have been refinished. So maybe Friday afternoon I'll take possession of my vehicle, although I'm suspecting that they've been kind of dilly-dallying with the final tune-up. So I don't know. We'll see. But it's been a real, you know, I have to say that the internet is probably going to really take off. Because there's just so much good stuff on there.
The internet?
Yeah.
Do you think?
I do. I think it's a try, a buy, and not a fry. But I have...
You don't think it's too full of vitriol and cats?
Well, Dwight's doing his part for sure. So, with classic car restoration, I'm having a flashback to learning about computers. Because remember when you're trying to get to understand computers and technology, and you had a real curious mind about it because you really had this idea of, like, if I knew how to make these things work, I could do these things. But I don't know how they exactly work, so I need to find people that will teach me how to do this. And you go to the experts, you go to the computer nerds, and then as you're plying them for knowledge and you're taking that knowledge and you're applying it to what you're doing, you realize that the experts don't really seem to know what they're talking about or what they're doing. They're kind of fudging it a little bit.
That never happens.
It totally happens in the world of auto mechanics. So, you know, I have had to, you know, as we've gone through the restoration on this vehicle, I have had to learn about my car, which is great, and I love that. I don't feel like I'm just like, here, I've handed it off to someone, they're going to do it, and they're going to give it back to me. I've had to actually intervene and say, okay, you're not doing this right. There's a part we need. And so I've been able to actually go on the internet, learn how to do the installation of a new top on a car, figure out what parts are involved, and then not only that, but be able to find those parts. You know, there's a lot of what the term is new old stock.
NOS, yeah.
NOS, yeah. So you can go out there. And so I had no idea that I could actually go and find a rain gutter for a 1971 Cutlass Supreme convertible assembly, which I need because the one that I have is cracked because I went and looked.
I knew that was a big car, but I had no idea it had gutters on there. That's
it has
crazy.
Gutters too, wow. So that the rain coming down will not go into your trunk.
Yeah. Oh, I know what those are, actually. Whoa.
Yeah.
It's about cars. Cool.
I didn't know I knew anything about automotive repair. So rain gutters. I got a rain gutter for my car, and I got weather stripping for the car because they're going to put all the top on and not put any weather stripping in it. So anyway, maybe.
So you caught that. They were just going to, you would have found out.
They would have said, well, we don't have the weather stripping for this, and that wasn't included in the thing. So I went and found they actually have some OEM parts for that, and I bought them, and I took them over there, and I said, okay, when they do the install, here's going to need this. And so I've had to kind of teach them a little bit about how they're fixing my car.
Don't you guys have Google?
Well, there's some really great resources online for buying old car parts. If you really want to do it, you can.
The next piece will be when you can 3D print the missing part that's obscure or CNC mill it because you can't get it any other way.
That would be cool. I mean, if you mm-hmm. could, if somebody who has, you know, and obviously, and again, this is going to be a situation where people with the knowledge are not going to want to share it out to the masses because they'll lose their stranglehold on it. Somebody out there would have to go out and buy that. The rain gutter is just this big piece of plastic. It's not even a big piece of plastic. It's just a little strip of plastic that form fits around the back of the car. And if you could scan that with a 3D scanner, get the specs on it, you could conceivably print that out at any time, if you could just go and download the whatever, what do you call the file that you use to send to a 3D printer?
Just the file, STL file. It depends on what format you're sending. But yeah, like, you know, your build file.
Whatever. I mean, because you can go online right now and you can get the file, whatever it's called, the file that you need to print a wrench or print a bolt or whatever that a 3D printer. Because you can go and get stuff. Like there's libraries of that stuff out there.
That gets into a tricky kind of area where you get into design. So Ben, I know we've rehashed this, you know, a couple shows ago, I guess maybe before Fundraiser with Lee. But you know, there are things that are controlled because, you know, they're actual physical things, you know. So you know, there are cutless parts that I guess GM helped me out with my car.
Yeah,
ignorance.
GM.
So GM would make a cutless part, they'd make a bumper, and you had to get that bumper from GM. And they weren't really concerned about people ripping off the design, because to do it, you would kind of have to do a factory and make a whole bunch of them. And GM would say, hey, Ford, we noticed you stole our bumper. But now, who owns, so can GM come in and say, hey, you can't print a cutless rain gutter because we own that design? Or is it going to be like fair use because it's an object and you can just go...
At this point right now, there are aftermarket vendors that make they make replicas of vintage
without having to pay anything back to the original companies.
I don't think that they do. I don't think they have to. I think,
or is it after a certain amount of years? I wonder.
Well, for a 1971 Oldsmobile Cutlass Supreme, Oldsmobile's not making any money. They won't sell you the part. I can't go to Oldsmobile and buy a new bumper for them. So there's somebody out there that fabs, you know, does those bumpers and makes them.
Yeah, I think the rules are handled differently for car stuff, so that, you know, as long as GM is selling it, then it's tougher for somebody to knock off the part and sell it. But if GM ever isn't, when it goes to that status where it's not a new part that they're providing, then I think it's open season. Then it's wide open for whoever will take the time to. I think legally it's sort of open season, and the big limiter is more just having the tooling and the equipment to make those parts. And fortunately, I mean, the early 70s GM stuff is still very popular, and so you can get, you know, so there's, you can, it seems to me, you can almost buy all the pieces to make a, you know, 71 Cutlass convertible out of brand new parts, although you would be spending an insane amount of money to do it, but you could.
Yeah, I mean, conceivably, if you could just fab your own pieces, and even if you couldn't make them as high grade as you could do in you know, a proper shop, you could do it cheap enough to where you could make it twice as often. So if, you know, instead of getting one convertible top frame that lasts you for 20 years, you can make one cheaply that lasts for 5 years and make three of them.
I think there will be. There's going to be someone in the market that's going to want to publish designs, and they're going to want to somehow control the designs. And I think it's going to usher in a new ugly era for DRM. You know, because, you know, how are you going to control, like, you know, if you print out like this J. Lee, you know, thing that just does this one special thing, and you want to control it, and it's designed to be printed, maybe it like prints and it does something special for your model of camera and it fits you and there's all this stuff. how do you control that? Like, as you know, as a maker, if you saw that, you know, out in the wild, like some guy shooting professional sports that can afford to buy professional gear, and he had one of yours that, you know, was printed out, and you could tell it wasn't yours, like it didn't have the little, you know, who knows how you would DRM it. But that gets into an issue too. It's like they're going to have to get into physical DRM and have to police that. And I don't like.
Well, they're kind of having to
do
that to a certain extent, where there's some stuff going on where this woman has designed her own jewelry, like, you know, like she makes this, she doesn't print it, but she makes, like, you know, these ornaments and stuff, and this large retailer has taken all of her designs and mass produced them and started selling them. So she's having to the woman who actually created the designs is having to go and fight them and finding it very difficult to do. Easy enough to prove that she created it, but yeah, it gets into some really weird, complex issues. But for right now, I'm glad that there are people out there that are dedicated enough to recreate the.
Oh yeah,
I could reassemble my car with all new parts, all new panels, and everything that are just third party manufacturers. That
like Johnny Cash style, but do it in like several weeks instead of a decade.
And
or
they
two.
Would all fit, and they might all fit yeah. together better than the original panels did.
They might. All right, so I see we have a call on the line, Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who do we have, and what do they want?
Oh, we'll speak to Matthew.
Matthew, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, I just want to talk about the Super Bowl, the news after the Super Bowl. There was a lot of news coverage that showed people at home, in their living room, in their kitchens, and various other places, where it was in the news, and it seems like the pictures were being taken from the television.
Maybe Xbox. I wonder if the eye has been peering into people's living rooms. And
I have no idea.
I didn't see the news coverage you're talking about, but I don't think that those pictures were obtained clandestinely. What I think probably happens in those news stories, from the ones that I've seen in the past, is that the news crews will go into the houses or some place where large gatherings are, and they may set the camera up next to or behind the TV.
A lot of people set up their own cameras, their own phones, you know, in front of the TV to catch their reaction to things. So that, you know, could be coming from that, too.
Yeah.
And they send in it to the news stations, maybe?
Sure. Why not? People get very enthused about things like the Super Bowl, and want to, you know, if the news agencies might say, send us a video of you watching
being on
us.
TV.
Exactly.
Send a video.
Yeah,
of you
just like the weather. Very
enthusiastic, every last one of them. And they were very professional looking. That's why I called.
Well, I didn't see them myself, but I know that the news, I know a lot of the news agencies are asking people to send in video and still images, because that, like, I've sent photographs to Channel 13 here in Houston for weather related stuff, because Tim Heller he'll say, you know, send us your pictures of the ice storm or whatever, and I'll send that stuff in, because it's kind of cool, because what they'll do is they'll, you know, in a video situation like you're describing, somebody get a big kick out of seeing themselves on a news broadcast, so they might create those videos. But also, news crews will go in and say, you know, we're here, you know, we know that this guy is throwing this big Super Bowl party. Can we come and film it, you know, for our news broadcast tonight?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't think it was a Big Brother situation.
No,
I think
it wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The technology is there. You never know.
Well,
you got these little pinhole cameras.
Yeah,
why couldn't they put one in the television?
Matthew, let's apply just a little bit of common sense here. If I am a major news outlet, say like I'm ABC.
Right.
And I have the ability, let's just say I have the ability to tap into your Xbox camera or put a camera in your house without your knowledge. And then
you wouldn't put it on the air.
I wouldn't put it on the air because somebody's going to say, hey, I saw you on TV.
No, that's a genius. So you control the medium, so you just don't stream back to those houses. Media blackout.
Right. So, I think, you know, looking for the conspiracy, you have to apply, like, even if they do have the ability to, do they want to tip their hand?
Yeah.
So chances are all the video that's being collected of you clandestinely will never be broadcast.
They were human interest stories. Right. However, there's a big movement I know with like the Xbox One, and I'm not sure if this is happening on the PlayStation 4, but a lot of them, I think Xbox One, a lot of them ship with the camera, with the Kinect. So there's a big thing where you can stream yourself playing games, and people will just go and watch other people playing games. So it's like, if you're familiar with like PewDiePie, it's kind of in that vein, but everyone gets to do that. So that's kind of eerie, because that is a situation where you do have a camera that's kind of always on. It's always listening, so you can say like, you know, Xbox One, turn on, and it'll turn on because it's always there. And that gets more Big Brother, but there's no way the networks were doing that.
I'll tell you what, to Matthew's credit, though, the level of paranoia about being viewed by your technology, I work in the IT department for a software company, and, you know, I have to manage equipment as people leave the company or they upgrade their computer stuff. And I will tell you that 20 to 30% of the laptops I get back have tape over the camera. Because people just don't want, there's no chance I'm going to even give you the opportunity to spy on me. I'm going to tape over, blank, I'm just going to tape over
my green light's on now, and I feel like I'm being watched. So,
I do too. You know? So, yeah, so I've, and, yeah, Pete's giving me like hands, jazz hands. So there's some concern that if you have a live camera in your house, like tied to an Xbox or on your laptop or whatever, that it could be remotely turned on. And a lot of TV shows kind of use that as a story device where, you know, they can turn on your phone and listen to you. Or
that's a little far-fetched, but there is some concern, you know, like especially with phones, you know, if you can get a phone to connect to, we've talked about like femtocells or fake cell phone towers or stuff like that, you could conceivably control the phone function on there. So really the only way to know that, you know, what's going through your cameras and going anywhere else is to put a little bit of tape on there.
Yeah, that's what
so
I
that
do.
That is pretty paranoid.
My,
I mean, that's the thing. I think
you
it's
know,
not.
I mean, that's something that's been out for a long time. There's been a lot of cases where citizens tapped into college dorms and you know.
Well, it's certainly filmed, getting.
And literally filmed co-eds in their you know.
Yeah, in their dorm.
I think that's a different kind of.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly the technology is such to where I could conceivably spy on someone with a pinhole camera clandestinely placed in the house or in the dorm room or whatever. That's something that we have to worry about. And even with robotics and drone technology getting to where people can, you know, you're not even safe on the roof of your own house.
Yeah. Our technology is quickly outstripping, you know, our civil rights and our right to privacy. So we've got to be real careful about that. Because that's the whole thing they're looking at now is, you know, drone flyovers and being able to look through imaging walls and infrared and, you know, being able to stake out someone's home for 4 or 5 days straight and what's expected. So there have been a few court cases that have said, hey, you can't watch someone's entrance and exit for 5 days straight because that pins them down. You know, that's not fair. But there's a lot of stuff they haven't quite figured out yet.
Yeah.
Like they haven't figured out how to stop people from accidentally sending nude photos or videos of themselves to, oh, say their Twitter feed or things like that. You know, it's not just someone else violating your privacy. There's a lot of people who are sort of violating their own privacy by accident.
They're violating good sense, I think, on some of that. Yeah.
Thanks for your call, Matthew, and I hope we've alleviated some of your fears.
Hey, good luck on your car, man.
Thank you.
Wave to the camera, Matthew. Bye-bye. Bye.
That's okay. If you want to see Matthew's call, you can go on our website after the show.
Oh, he's waving. Oh, that's cool.
Running towards the other camera. That's funny.
he turned from the main camera. He's looking at the back.
He's putting tape over the wrong camera.
Oh, man. That reminds me, too.
He doesn't have enough tape. It's fine.
Let me just, as a pro tip, if you are using company equipment and you want to block the camera, take just a little extra step and put a piece of paper over the lens and then tape it. Don't just stick the glue right onto the lens. Please. I've got one coming back that the user has already told me that he put tape right on the lens.
That's no good. I know I've seen a couple of
those. And over the USB ports.
Oh, nice.
What was that for?
Keep the Twix out.
Yep.
References. Apparently now he works with one of our customers has some real weird security stuff, and they don't want to see open USB ports where people can.
Oh,
I don't
my
know.
Gosh,
that's just kind
of
weird.
That's
though.
Really temporary though. I'm like, solder the USB port shut. A little bit of tape isn't going to do
super
much.
Glue in it or something.
Put a Twix in it.
Excuse me. Thank you. All right. Oh, I saw the call was on the line, but now it's gone. You had a call for us, didn't you, Groovehouse?
That was the show within the show. Groovehouse was doing some tech support.
Right.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Saving you from the headache.
That's fine. If you got a spyware question, Groovehouse is now equipped to
try flipping the Twix upside down and reinserting it.
If
I just told him to do the Jay Lee maneuver.
All right, so scavenger hunt. If you go to geekradio.com and go into the photo section, the Twix
reference
USB. USB reference will be made clear if you find the right photo.
Good luck.
It's in there.
It is in there.
And it's not in any of the Geek Gathering.
It's not in very high res either.
No.
This was a long time ago.
God, there's some great photos in there too. I forget about this sometimes. All right, 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight, if you got something you want to talk about. That was pretty good. You know, I didn't mind having that conversation. It was not a spyware question, so that was good. But if you want to be on the air and talk about anything that we've talked about previously, you're welcome to do so. We're going to go back to our previous discussion, since there's no calls on the line, which was new tech. Did you have a few other items that you wanted to talk about, Pete?
Yeah, a couple of them. One is I started on it before the break, the poorly named Dell Venue 8 7000. It's Venue 8 and then 7000, I guess, is sort of the model.
For what's supposed to be the thinnest tablet out, that's a huge, huge name. The name is thicker than the tablet will ever be.
It is bigger than the tablet, yes. The things that are interesting about the Dell is, first off, it's an Intel-powered Android tablet. It has KitKat on it. It is a, the Dell Venue 8, so it's essentially an 8-inch screen. The thing is that it does differently is it has a very minimal bezel on it. So if you're familiar with the the Google Nexus 7, which is not a chunky tablet by any stretch, if you lay them down next to each other laid one on top of the other, the Venue 8 is only about a half an inch taller, a half an inch longer than the 7-inch Google Nexus 7, which has a 7-inch screen. So essentially they've crammed a much larger screen into a smaller form factor by making the bezels smaller. It has a 2560 by 1600 8.4-inch screen. Like I said, it's Intel-powered. It comes with 16 gigs of storage in it that can be expanded by micro SD, so you could put like 128 gig chip in there and boost the capacity. It doesn't have LTE yet, but that's coming in May. And it has an 8 megapixel rear camera with RealSense, which is the 3D. It uses the three cameras so that you can do things like take pictures with it and then refocus them afterwards. And it comes for about $400. So it's not inexpensive, but it's got some kind of high-end features to it. The only thing I found a review by Ars Technica on it that would certainly influence your try, buy, or fry on it, but I'll say it, is they say that the lack of the bezel makes it hard to hold it. It's got sort of a chin on it, and that's really the only place you can grab it, or else there are accidental screen selects and things like that happen. And the other thing that they said in their review is that that the Intel stuff kind of holds it, that it kind of holds it back, that its GPU performance is not as good as its price bracket, and that it's that they actually, at the end of the review, they say that you could get a first generation iPad Air or an iPad Mini 3, and that unless you were dead set on running Android, you probably would like the iPad better for your money.
KitKat's a little older, right? I mean, right? Kit Kat's not the current operating system.
Lollipop is, yeah. Kit Kat was the 4 series.
And they haven't announced when Lollipop will be coming to that one. So I'm guessing that one. You may want to look at it if you're a big Android fan. The other thing they say, though, sort of on the flip side of the cons to it, is that where did they with the end of the Nexus 7, with the Google Nexus 7 gone, they said it's harder to find truly great Android tablets between $200 and $250, and that this is sort of the closest thing that you get to it. I mean, although it's more like $400, so it's a big jump, but it is sized similarly in that. So I'm thinking that, that one, this is more informative. I don't know I guess I would try it if somebody gave it to me to try, but I would probably make it'd be unlikely to be a buy for me.
Doesn't seem to hold much of a heel for me.
Too rich for my blood.
There you go.
I don't really need a tablet, so I'd probably fry.
And I am sad to see the Nexus 7s go. That definitely leaves a hole in the marketplace and a hole in my heart.
The last one's kind of the most interesting, and unfortunately it's very new, and so there's not a lot of info on it. It's called the Eero Wi-Fi system, E-E-R-O. And what it is it's mesh networking for at home. And so what you're supposed to do is you buy multiple Eero boxes, you plug them into your existing modem, and then place other ones throughout the house, and they handle all the kind of syncing up and networking and all that. And the goal is that it covers your whole house, not just not just the spot where you've got a router or a couple routers. It has a smartphone based app to control it. And if your guest has the app, you can give them you can give them guest access, and you can even like how long their access is for, and stuff like that. And I guess the final thing is, it's got a kind of white, apple-y looking, very minimal, just got an active light on it. So it's got that kind of modern white minimalist design, so you don't have to hide it if you don't want to. It seems mesh networking sounds kind of cool to me. Basically, they're $125 a piece, so they're not cheap, but it seems like if you've got 2 or 3 of those, you could cover just about any area you wanted where everybody would have good Wi-Fi wherever they were in the house or even backyard.
So is it like kind of I'm kind of familiar with the concept of mesh networking, but as far as this one, does it behave sort of like WWDS or something where you like lose bandwidth because it's mesh network?
I would think you would almost have to, unless the trend now is also to like just throw as many radios and devices as you can, which is how you get like a lot of the MMO stuff. So I heard about this and I was kind of curious about it, because I'm like, okay, why can't people just do mesh, or why isn't someone else doing it? But the guys behind it, it's the one of the designers that did the Roku, one of the designers behind the GoPro 3, and the designer behind the Nest thermostat. So because of that, I'm a little curious to see what they come out with. Otherwise, I'd be kind of nonplussed.
Are these the ones... So I thought somebody was coming out with something like similar to this, where it's mesh networking. But it actually... they were making some that actually would replace your electrical outlets. So it actually goes in the wall as an electrical outlet, but it also, so it gets its power from basically being an electrical outlet.
Yeah, that's been a while, and I don't think those ever came to market. And that still may be like a little bit too Home Depot-y, or a little bit too do-it-yourself-y for people that, instead of having to take out a wall socket and do some wiring and mess with some stuff like that, and you still might not have enough room, they'd just rather plug something in, which I think is what...
Well, this one, this says it uses 802.11 AC, and it'll do the it either does 5 gigahertz or 2.4 gigahertz, depending on, it'll switch automatically between them using whichever is most free and clear.
Ooh, it's got a Bluetooth built in too, so I'm wondering if they're not going to use Bluetooth to configure it out of band.
Yeah, apparently you get a new one, you put it down next to your existing one, and it sets itself up, and then you go put it where you want. So I definitely would put that in the try category, because it doesn't have all the configuration pain of a network extender, it looks like. They also have a thing that says that they monitor themselves. It's like the Nest and those others where it's marketing language, but it's still, if it's true, it's good. It says if it has a problem or goes down momentarily, it simply reboots itself and fixes the problem before you even know there's a problem. It says put away the paperclip.
Does it say what the range of one is? So you have an idea of, like, if you have a, you know, two-story house that, you know.
I don't think they're doing anything revolutionary. Like, I think they're just using standard radios with standard everything. I think the magic here is in the configuration and how it's like a kind of a quote-unquote zero configuration.
So for a McMansion, you'd probably need six or eight.
You'd need a lot, yeah. Although it looks like you can buy them in three packs, you know.
Well, and what 802.11 AC has got pretty strong range and speed at range, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's definitely better. I think it uses two frequencies to double the speed.
Yeah, this looks like it's going to have two radios. It's going to have a 2.4 gigahertz radio and then, you know, a 5 gigahertz radio. So it'd be cool if it had, like, two of each to where it could double up, but it looks like it's just going to be one of each.
So, yeah, they're at Eero, Eero.com, if anybody wants to sort of research it further, especially anybody listening to kind of figure out how it works in that. I mean, if it's just that simple, because the thing is, I've done places where you're setting up more than one router, and it gets to be kind of, you know, it's a pain in the neck unless you happen to also have access to, say, a wired network so that you can, you know, you can extend the wired network and not just do, range extension with a Wi-Fi only range extender.
Well, to get it right, it's a lot like configuring static routes. It's kind of hard to do. So this is odd. So I'm not finding a lot of technical specs, but one of their spokespeople said, okay, additionally, repeaters sometimes cut bandwidth in half, if not more. And it sounds like they're speaking to the fact that this device does not do that. So that could be interesting to see how they're getting around.
Hmm. Right. Yeah, they don't use WDS.
If you had a repeater on your router, on your Wi-Fi access point, then it cuts the speed by half or more.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right. So that's what we were discussing. It sound like there's no way they can get around that. It sounds like they might have gotten around it, which is interesting. Maybe they build, so maybe they've got some other protocol and they just do direct, you know, they say like, okay, Jay Lee wants to talk, so instead of, you know, well, I don't know. No, that still seems like they'd have to take a hit on the bandwidth, working out in my head. So who knows?
All right, well, we do have a couple of calls in the queue. I did discover a new feature of my MacBook Air, and when the battery gets down to about 5%, I don't think that's going to fit on here.
No, I think we've been through this before. I'm going to try it just in case.
Yeah, no, that doesn't. Well, let's see. Does it? It's not lighting up. No.
Flip it around, just in case.
No, it's a whole different connector on mine than yours. Okay. Yeah. So what I discovered is that when the MacBook Air gets down to about 5% battery, the fan kicks in and won't stop, and then it just drives the rest of the battery down. So it's like it's a feature. It's a feature in the Mac OS that says, okay, you've drained your battery down to 5%. Let's reach zero as quick as we possibly can. Oh, look, click the trigger.
If only you had some butane.
Wait a minute. Did you get a new computer?
So they went back to that style? I don't like that style.
This the original style? Is this original?
What? We're talking about the magnetic.
I know. The magnetic the hookup for the charger on the MacBook. Do you have a new
No, the original one on the Air was that style. Because the thing is, the original charger was at an angle underneath it, and so you couldn't use that straight style, which was what was originally on the MacBook Pros. But the original MacBook Air was that 90-degree angled one.
Yeah.
But then with the newer models after Barrett's without a backlit keyboard, I just have to mention that.
No, that's still painful.
They went to the straight connectors, the same as the MacBook Pros use.
All right, we lost one of our calls, but we still have one in the queue. So let's talk to this person.
All right.
Roof House, who do we have?
Up next, we're going to speak with Joe.
Joe, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, guys. I can't hear you too well. If you can hear me.
We can.
I'm curious about the life expectancy on the Nexus 7. I bought a Nexus 7 about 2.5 years ago. I loved it. But about 2.5 months ago, it died on me really hard. It just will not come back up. I tried to even do a factory reset several times. I just can't get the thing to come back to life. And I'm wondering if maybe Well, about 2.5 years is the life expectancy of those things. I'm wondering what you guys
Was it
think.
The first generation or the second generation Nexus 7?
Oh, wow. I think it's the second generation, but I don't know for sure.
The 2013 one, yeah, is the second generation. If it was brand new and it was, you know, like $240 in 2013, then that
exactly.
would be the second gen.
I cut it on sale just over $200.
I have a Nexus 7 and that I got around that, you know, that I got in 2013. And because the iPad mini with Retina display was long in the future, mine still works great. I haven't had any problem.
Was there any chance that your Nexus 7 had drained completely in battery life? Like, had you not used it for a little bit, or did you drain all the way in battery life and then let it sit for a day or two?
No, I used it daily, but as one of the tricks, I tried to do that. Somebody suggested that actually drain the battery all the way dead and then start recharging it again. So I actually tried that a couple of times, but I just never had much luck. In the boot up process, it always just gets stuck in just always trying to boot up and never gets to the finishing stage.
Oh, so it's not completely bricked then? This is good.
This is good.
Hey, Barrett.
Hey, Barrett.
How are you?
Oh, it's probably my fault. There we go.
I'm sorry? What?
Never mind. I got my computer to come back on. I rejoined the Hangout, and I forgot to mute myself. So you haven't completely bricked it, maybe.
So it's powering up. You can see some activity on it. That's different than
being completely dead. It tries to power up, but it just never gets past the initial... when it's really, really long battery, it just literally shows you a little battery icon as it's sort of charging, getting to some
is
kind of a neutral state.
Is it possible you just have a bad battery?
That is conceivable, I guess.
Two and a half years, that could be...
Daily use, it could go, but it should take a little bit of a charge if you just leave it on the charger for a few days and power it up. It shouldn't get stuck. It should let you power all the way up.
I charge it for almost a week and it never gets past the... the process of the boot up.
Well, let me just answer your question directly. I mean, the life expectancy of these phones should be longer than 2.5 years.
Okay.
So the fact that your phone is having a problem after that amount of time is not because of any obsolescence built into the hardware. It's just failed, like hardware will fail.
Yeah.
Maybe have you tried booting into safe mode?
I know
that sounds like
what?
A Windows Sleep move. Mode? But you can actually do it. So I believe you just hold the power off, and then when you power it back on, just touch and hold the power off button and just keep holding it. And eventually a little thing will come up and it'll be like safe mode or, you know, boot from something else.
Yeah, that's right, because tech services suggested something like that and walked me through a process.
Oh, and did you try that and it didn't do anything? It still freezes?
Yeah,
it still
I couldn't
freezes.
Get that far. There was two different tricks they recommended that we walked through, and neither one of those worked. But yeah, there is a possibility of booting it up in a different format, so to speak, but I couldn't get that far.
And like Jay Lee said, it could be, you know, you could have a hardware issue, just something failed, you could have something bad, and when, you know, the code hits this one part, it breaks. But I would think that if it's at least booting and you're getting to the part where it, you know, you can get into safe mode, you can see different things. I don't know if you want to go this way, but you could possibly reload the OS if something just got corrupted in there.
That would certainly be worth a shot.
Yeah, and there are definitely, you know, step-by-step instructions on how to do that, and you don't necessarily have to go with CyanogenMod. I know that people have put the different firmwares out there, and you can go refresh with a brand-new kind of quote-unquote factory firmware for that. And though it's kind of the same as doing, like, a forced factory reset, and that's probably your best bet. If that doesn't do it, it probably is a hardware issue.
Yeah, is there an option on that type of a device to replace my battery?
It's sealed, so
is
you'd
it
have
sealed?
To. Yeah, you'd have to break the back off, and you'd have to maybe resolder one in. But I bet there are people that are doing it. Let me see.
I might be able to research that online.
One thing that also sort of speaks against the idea that the hardware is just, you know, just weak and you know, that it wears out too early for more people than, you know, obviously sometimes you just get a bad unit. Right now, the places that still have 2013 Nexus 7s. They haven't lowered the price much, if at all, on them, and that's a sign that they can still sell them and that they're still good and that they're still working.
Yeah, when it worked, I loved that device. I thought it was a great little tablet.
Yeah, I'm still a big fan.
Sad that Google dropped that layer. I thought that was unfortunate when they came out with the new one and stopped doing.
Oh, sorry, Pete. You can actually go out and replace the battery. It looks like it's not too hard. You just kind of pop the back off with a plastic tool, and it looks like the battery pack actually has a connector. There are a few different breakdowns and walkthroughs. The one that looks pretty decent is on iFixit, like, you know, iFixit.com. And there's a guide for the Nexus 7 battery replacement. It takes you through how to do it. So that could be a thing, too. I know that with the LiPo batteries, if it doesn't display a certain amount of charge, it won't even turn on. So you could be getting to the point where, you know, it just says, hey, we're not going to go any further because we don't have enough batteries. But that would at least get you some new juice if you could fix the software problem.
All right. All right.
Sounds like, yeah.
Sounds like that's it. Just once he had his health, he's gone.
I'm done with you guys. All right. So there's about 20 minutes left in the show tonight. Technology Bites here. And if you wanted to call in, you can dial 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT.
Got a couple of quick science stories.
Let's do the science. Room. Science!
When this baby hits 88 miles an hour, you're going to see some serious science. This one was kind of interesting. The FAA, you know, that regulates civil aviation here in the United States, is planning to use its framework for licensing space launches to license business on the moon, according to a scoop from Reuters this morning.
Is this
a lunar land grab? Not exactly. The report takes the form of a letter from the FAA to Bigelow Aerospace, which is a private company that's developed expandable living modules for the ISS and hopes to put inflatable modular living stations on the moon and Mars. The letter is about whether Bigelow would be able to claim the right to develop a habitat on a particular part of the moon without any other mission or project interfering. According to Reuters, the FAA says that Bigelow's theoretical development would be protected. So it's going to use existing launch licensing authority. Oh, there's one for every episode. To encourage private sector investment in space systems by ensuring that commercial activities can be conducted on a non-interference basis. So I guess we need to start planning for the Technology Bites moon base and get in our get our territory. The thing is, I'm betting the key part of this is you have to be able to do it. You know, in other words, you can't just say, oh, yeah, you know, we're planning to go up there.
If I had the ability to get to the moon, I would claim this.
Yeah, if you actually can put up a station, you can get the right and do it. But if you just, you know, you can't just grab the right and hold on to it. Other exploration stuff, they're going farther than the moon. The White House budget request for 2016 is proposing a robotic mission concept to Europa to be launched in the mid-2020s. They're looking to get, they call it the Europa Clipper. It's a Jupiter-orbiting spacecraft that will make multiple flybys of the Jovian moon Europa over a three-year period. It will dive deep into Jupiter's radiation belts to fly over Europa's surface approximately 45 times during its mission. It's like Cassini did with Saturn, flying by the moon Titan, but the Europa Clipper would be focused on Europa in an effort to understand its habitable potential, because there's water. That's one that they're sure that they think that it has three times the volume of water held in Earth's oceans. They think that there's the real possibility of life on Europa. And finally, the data, you know, all of us now have, you know, a large number of people have smartphones and data plans. And the thing that's interesting is Cisco's Mobile Visual Networking Index, which estimates the mobile data that we're consuming. They say that right now the entire world is going from consuming 2.5 exabytes. I think that's what it's terabytes, petabytes, and then exabytes. As far as, you know, orders of magnitude, 2.5 exabytes a month in 2014. They project that it'll be 25 exabytes of mobile data per month, around the world in 2019, with a large portion of that growth coming from Latin America, China, and the Middle East. Oh, just for comparison's sake, an exabyte is a billion gigabytes. So your cell phone plan, it has, you know, 2 gigabytes. Or if your cell phone data plan has 1 gigabyte of data per month, then that's a billion of those plans around the world doing data. So the growth is just pretty amazing. So that's something worth watching. And how will the world change when 25 exabytes of data is going out per month to smartphones all around the world? Yeah, and you think think about how much if your 2 gigs costs how much, then how much is being paid out to get to that 25 exabytes? So, and as we add wearables, you know, there's going to be more stuff. You know, I think the Internet of Things is going to involve a lot more mobile data, and that's part of why they think the traffic is going to go up so much.
You know, I was thinking in terms. This just struck me because you were talking about the mesh networks and talking about your home internet and so forth. So right now with mobile data, you have multiple devices connected to your mobile plan. So you have, like in my house, for example, we have 2 cell phones and an iPad all sharing data on 1 mobile plan. But the 3 devices don't talk to each other like they would on a local network. So I wonder if there's a move towards being able to consolidate your devices into a private network with each other.
Yeah, it'd have to be like a VPN kind of thing, but I would assume they're going to eventually do that, to where all your devices can communicate with each other without other devices being able to eavesdrop or, you know, mess with the integrity of the communications.
Or even maybe some kind of technology that would allow you to do an ad hoc between the multiple devices. I mean, you already kind of have that with AirDrop over your Wi-Fi, or over your data plan. But if there was some, and I guess you could do it with Bluetooth.
They're getting there. And there was even, I saw something where I guess it was for the prepper kind of market. But you can take your cell phone, and then there's this little bitty like stick that looks about the size of like maybe a Kit Kat bar or something like that. And what it is it's got a radio, and then it's also got a cell phone radio. And what it does is it allows your cell phone to communicate with this thing, and then it punches out, and it goes not through like, you know, AT&T or Verizon or any of the large mobile carriers' airwaves, but it does a direct radio connection to anyone else carrying one of these sticks, and you can let it communicate that way. So I think you're going to see, I think there's going to be a big push.
So it's like a new version of a walkie-talkie.
Yeah, more or less. So that's exactly, everything old is new again. But I think there's going to be a big push by everyone to say, hey, put all your data in the cloud, put everything in the cloud. I think there's going to be, hopefully, the pendulum will swing back, and people will say, I don't want the cloud, I want personal networks where it, like Jay said, it just goes directly and it does not go out there anywhere else. But
right.
That's not what the NSA wants. That's not what a lot of people want. So we'll see how
they're
it goes
starting.
Out.
There's starting to be a focus on kind of how you do the sort of privacy or the keeping information secure. I read about a business app that lets you share business documents to other people and they can read them, but at a certain point, basically the document deletes itself. So that it goes away. So you can send a business document or legal document to somebody and they can see it and read it, but that then it has a finite life and is gone, and other people obviously can't see it.
It's always tough because you can screen capture it or you can take a picture of it. And, you know, Jay Lee and I went to a talk that was getting around Snapchat and getting around some things like that. So I'm always a little bit leery of things that say it's disappeared.
I guess my point is the desire to make something that does that is a positive step, that because even trying to set it up, you're going to learn something, and people hacking it is going to teach, you know, you start the arms race, but it does raise the chance that somebody will come up with real privacy protection.
I think two guys from Ireland, I don't remember they were involved in, I can't remember the name of the software now, but it's software that basically gives you kind of a cloud-based distributed network share, and individuals sign up and then offer some of their space on their hard drives or on their server's hard drives or whatever into this cloud of storage, and then when you upload a file, it's encrypted and then split across all these different servers I assume with like RAID style, like redundancy across all these different systems. And then when you want the file, it comes back to you and you're the only one that can unencrypt it. So your data is spread all over in different places and it's all encrypted pieces and it can't really be put together except anyway, it's an interesting
that's a
concept.
Cool, yeah.
Well, the other thing I'm thinking too is because broadband is so fast. I mean, now, you know, my data speeds on my cell phone over cellular are just blazing fast, you know, 50 megabits or so down. And, you know, the reason I have high speed at home is, because you couldn't get that on your mobile devices before, but now you can. But one of the benefits of a home network is that, again, all the devices will talk to each other. So even Comcast has this new service that they've rolled out on their X1 platform, which allows any of my mobile devices, my laptop or my desktop or my phone or my iPad, I can log in with an app and I can watch Comcast broadcasts on my device live, which, as long as I'm on that network. So with your cellular broadband, you're limited because you have data caps. You have very severe data caps, like 5 gigabytes a month or 3 gigabytes a month. And I'm chewing through on my home internet, I'm chewing through easily 80 to 100 gigabytes of data a month, sometimes as much as 150, you know, with all the streaming and stuff that I'm doing. So I'm kind of tied into having to have this home internet to have that much bandwidth. If it breaks out on the phone where you're not having to pay, you know, as much for the data, where you don't have the data caps, then it would make it almost be like, you know, when I got rid of my landline.
Yeah.
Getting rid of my cable for broadband because all of my devices have it. But one of the great benefits of the home network, again, file sharing and device sharing. So for my phone to be able, or my iPad to be able to print, it has to do it over the Wi-Fi or it has to do it over the internet. Through a little bit more trickery, but if I could have this kind of ad hoc network on my mobile devices, so I have a one data plan there that's all wireless all the time. I don't know.
Although for your home speed internet, all those devices when you are home get to use data off that. You know, they also are pulling large amounts of data off that same network where. If you're having to pay by the gig for your mobile stuff, it would be a lot more expensive.
No, absolutely.
You know, when your iPad's at home and your phone.
No, but if I had a mobile data plan that was not capped at 5 gigabytes, if I had, mm-hmm. you know, if I have 250 gigs, and I think that's coming. I think it's going to get to the point where your mobile data plans are going to be almost unlimited, if not completely unlimited data, as the infrastructure grows. There won't be a need for a landline internet.
It'll
connection.
Be inconvenient. It'll be kind of the old way to do it. It'll be cheaper to deploy it over wireless, I think, you know, than have it actually run wires. Yeah. I didn't know it had gotten that good. I've got my upstream here from the Montrose area is 20 megs, which I think is better than like my home.
My megabits.
Comcast
I was
connection.
Saying gigabits, but yeah, megabits.
Yeah.
But
30 megs down, 20 megs up is not too shabby for a phone that, you know, a couple years ago we weren't getting, I don't think, a tenth of that. I think we're done uploading, huh?
I think we may
speed
be.
Speed test is over.
I got like, down let me see share. What I'm getting my download speeds here on 3 bars on my on my phone, and I'm not connected to the Wi-Fi, so let's see what
yeah,
I'm
where
pulling.
Where do you weigh
in? Where do I weigh in on my speed test? My ping is running now, so it's a 63 millisecond ping, so I'm not going to do very good. It's about 5.7 inside here. That's not
KPFT
very good.
Wi-Fi.
No,
that's off. That's no Wi-Fi, right?
There's okay. No Wi-Fi turned on. But at home, I had one day I was doing about 60, 70 megabits down. It was insane. And that's as good as my home is sometimes.
Geek Gathering.
All right, Geek Gathering this Friday. Maybe a Cutlass Supreme. Certainly some Moog synthesizers. We're going to have a good time.
A few geeks.
So a few geeks here and there. Who knows?
High of 74, low of 64, I think.
We'll have the weather.
Temperate. No rain. 0% chance.
So come join us, and also tune in next week when we welcome back, hopefully, if he can drive himself after hurting himself, Lee Hutchinson back on Technology Bites. So
50% chance of Groovehouse at the
Geek Gathering.
Yeah.
Fair to partly groovy.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he
Groovehouse.
For the month of February, 90.1 KPFT has been selected as one of the local nonprofits competing for your vote at Okra Charity Saloon in downtown Houston. The concept is simple. For each drink purchased, guests receive one vote that they may cast that night for their favorite organization. The charity with the most votes at the end of the month receives the next month's proceeds. Okra is located at 924 Congress, near the corner of Main Street and Congress. Again, throughout the month of February, KPFT is one of the candidates for support. You can chip in to vote with the purchase when you patronize Okra. You can visit Okra on Congress anytime in February to cast a vote for KPFT. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
You listen to KPFT, you enjoy some of our fine programming, and you have done your part to keep us commercial-free by calling in a pledge of support. Hats off to you for taking that first step. But before you settle into that fantastic feeling, don't forget, you still need to send in that pledge of support to finalize your promise to KPFT.